There's a common phrase that goes, those who cannot learn from history are doomed to repeat it. This is Lisa Berry, and as we work our way through a pandemic in 2020, there are local experts who are looking back at what happened in the 1918 pandemic, for example, to see what can be learned or helpful. And one of them is Dr. Alex Navarro from the University of Michigan Center for the History of Medicine, and he's joining us now on 89.1 WEMU. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Navarro.
Thank you for having me.
You were already pretty aware of the 1918 pandemic before this really took hold, were you not?
Yes, we spent at the center many, many years studying the 1918 pandemic for various federal government reports.
So when did it hit you that, hey, we're living through another historic medical moment right now?
You know, it started really when we started receiving calls when the outbreak occurred in Wuhan, China. And then, of course, when we started getting reports of cases circulating in the United States, and then when those cases suddenly went the route of community transmission and they were not travel-related cases, that's when I realized, okay, we're probably in for something similar to 1918, at least in terms of the public health response.
And what kind of comparisons can you make?
You know, there are lots of comparisons. We have to keep in mind, of course, that it's 100 years different, and so we have, you know, better medical capacity now and technology, and there's also wartime in 1918. It's not today, but there are many comparisons. The social distancing measures that cities and states have implemented today were used largely in 1918, not as sweeping in 1918, but they closed things like movie theaters and saloons and churches and banned public gatherings. In some communities, they mandated the use of masks, such as in San Francisco and Denver and Seattle. And then at the other end of the pandemic, when they believed they were over their pandemics, many cities and states reopened, and about half of the cities and states that we studied reopened a little too soon, and they suffered a second spike of cases as people in all of the American cities we studied suddenly flocked to downtown entertainment districts to celebrate not only the end of the epidemic, but this was also around the end of the war, and so they wanted to celebrate that as well. And they suffered a second spike of cases in many cities, and the lesson then was that it proved almost impossible in many of these communities to re-implement a second set of social distancing measures, of business closures, because there wasn't the political or the economic will to do so. And so they basically just, went on grinding out the rest of the epidemic without any control measures or very few control measures.
How do you qualify that? I mean, people are already saying they're done staying home at this time in 2020, but that's not really the way this works, is it?
No, it's a huge concern. You know, there are competing definitions, really, of an epidemic. You have the public health epidemiological definition of an epidemic, and that's what we're living with today. But you also have sort of the social definition of an epidemic. And if you get enough people in society who simply refuse to believe that it's a problem, or if they don't care anymore and they're tired of living under those control measures, for all intents and purposes, the epidemic, at least socially speaking, is over. But of course, it's not over epidemiologically speaking. And those two things run into each other, and it can have disastrous consequences for public health.
So when I think about that, and I think about the pandemic of 1918, how did that end?
So, again, talking about the social definition, in many communities, they simply declared the epidemic was over when they got to a certain level of cases. There was a third wave of the disease. Really, we're talking about the deadly second wave, the fall wave. But there was a third wave of influenza in 1918, and there was another wave in the winter of 1920. And with influenza, rather, it becomes a seasonal phenomena. Enough people get immunity by getting infected. Today, we'll have the same thing. We'll also hopefully have a vaccine at some point. And the strain that was circulating in 1918, the H1N1 strain of influenza, eventually attenuated because enough people got sick and got immunity, and it became one of the seasonal strains of sort of background influenza for several decades until the next epidemic in 1957.
How many people died from the 1918 pandemic?
We don't really know for sure. The best estimates are in the United States, somewhere around 550 to maybe 650,000 Americans. I've heard estimates as high as 675,000. And worldwide, there's a big range, but anywhere between 20 million and maybe as many as 50 million people died.
So here's a big question. Do you think that's possible now in 2020?
I hope not. It's certainly... medically speaking, we have much better, we have ventilators now, for example, we have much better medical care. But if the healthcare system is overrun, and if people don't take social distancing measures and other public health measures seriously enough, the potential is there for a staggering number of deaths. You know, we're already over 100,000 American deaths in just a few months. We have a disease that is more infectious than influenza was in 1918. We don't know the true case fatality rate yet. It seems pretty high, about 6 to 7% in the United States. It's probably a little bit lower than that once we get a real handle on how many actual cases there are. All of the markers are there for this to be an incredibly deadly pandemic.
Have you been writing about it since you're a historian? Are you keeping track of what's happening and to share for future generations?
We have been. We've been capturing as much of the data as possible. We've been busy writing articles and op-ed pieces about how 1918 compares to today, as well as some of the differences between the two. It's important to remember the cultural and historic contexts are different.
Right, and that impacts the economy as well, does it not?
It definitely does. You know, in 1918, the economy was primarily a manufacturing economy, and this was wartime, so production continued today. We're dominated by the service sector, and of course, we've seen that the service sector economy has been really hard hit, with travel and hotels and restaurants being some of the hardest hit places in our economy. So that's one, you know, big difference between 1918 and today.
What's the takeaway? What can we learn from that pandemic? I know it was over 100 years ago, but is there anything that was learned that we can apply to what's happening now?
I think the big takeaway as we come out of the other side of these closure orders is that we need to be very careful about having protocols in place and a regimen in place to continue community mitigation as we try and get back to some sense of what will be normal, at least until we get a vaccine. And the big concern is that I'm seeing some of the same things that happened in 1918. When cities opened, people flocked to downtown areas, they got back to their life as normal, and cases continued. And in some circumstances, in cities such as Denver, for example, or St. Louis, Kansas City, that second spike of cases was actually higher than the first. And in the case of Denver, for example, they tried to implement a second round of closure orders. It went into effect for a few hours, and it met with such opposition from business leaders that they rescinded those orders, and they went with a mandatory mask order instead. And masks back then in 1918 were not nearly as effective as today, and so they suffered a very severe second spike of cases.
Yeah, you see a lot of pictures from the 1918 pandemic of people wearing masks. Was that a very common thing?
Not very prominent. There were communities, particularly in the West, that mandated their use. In other communities around the United States, they were recommended, and certainly some people chose to wear them as a method of protecting themselves and others. Like San Francisco, for example, the wearing of masks was made mandatory, and there was an attempt to tie it to the patriotic fervor that was going on because of the war effort. And there were slogans, don't be a mask slacker, for example, and to do your part to protect yourself and your community. If you couldn't fight in the war, at least you could wear a mask. That being said, while compliance, we believe, was fairly high, there was significant pushback. There were hundreds of people arrested in San Francisco for not complying with the mask order. In fact, at one point, the police chief said they had to stop arresting people because his jail cells were filling up too rapidly. The mayor and the health officer themselves were caught not wearing their masks at a boxing match, and they were both fined. And when San Francisco re-implemented a mask order in that second spike of cases in the winter of 1919, that met with such opposition that 2,000 people gathered, maskless, of course, to protest. And there were prominent city physicians as well as a member of the county board of supervisors who were part of this anti-mask league.
So in 1918, they actually had the phrase, don't be a mask slacker?
They did, yes.
That's pretty hip, don't you think, from way back then?
Yeah, you know, the term slacker was used in 1918 to refer to people who weren't doing their part to uphold the war effort, and so they applied this to people who weren't wearing masks as well.
So based on history, Dr. Navarro, what should we be more concerned about, the virus or humanity, the way people react to it?
Well, you know, we can't control the virus. We can potentially control humanity. We can certainly each control our own behavior. So I would say we need to be focused on good public health messaging and getting as many people to comply with good public health protocols as possible. I certainly understand that it's difficult to have businesses closed, for people to be out of work. The economy, I believe, is not going to recover until we're out of the other side of this pandemic, and that's not going to happen if people continue to circulate and we have huge spikes and waves of cases. So I would hope that we can all do our part to at least mitigate the effects of the pandemic as long as possible until we can get an effective vaccine online.
What do you think is the most important lesson that we can learn and carry forward and improve our lives with from the 1918 pandemic?
Well, I think the big lesson is that these orders, these social distancing orders, are very difficult to maintain for any length of time. In 1918, they were kept in place for typically about 3 to 5 weeks. We've done that longer now today, and we're seeing a significant backlash. I think people need to be prepared that if these outbreaks in various states start to flare up, we might have to go back to these social distancing measures, these stay-at-home orders. And people need to be prepared for that. The pandemic is going to be over when it's over. We're talking about a highly infectious disease. We're talking about a herd immunity threshold that might be as high as 70, perhaps 80%. And so until we get this under control through either enough infections, hopefully at a slow rate so we don't overwhelm our healthcare system, or preferably through a vaccine, this epidemic is going to be with us, and we need to learn how to adapt our behaviors to live under this reality that we have.
Dr. Alex Navarro from the University of Michigan Center for the History of Medicine, thanks for joining us here on 89.1 WEMU.
You're welcome.